Blog Talk Radio.
Killer Mike Bamboo. You already know. Yeah. No surprise, I'm from a gangbang culture, but we can keep it civil or pull a thang-thang on ya. Southern California where the sun don't quit, intergenerational gang so sons don't quit. But immediately you see that the problems that's in my city are secondary to what's propelling it in my city. I mean really break it down, take poor black and brown, educate them poor, take the jobs from out the town, then inundate them with sedative drugs and dumb TV, locked into a zoo and hunted daily by the police. Then you get a group of youth who know they don't belong, then they gather up and organize a number up strong. But see, the failure isn't seeing that the problem ain't the gang, it's the situation in the communities where we hang. So I'm so pro-gang, it might scare a motherfucker, cause I fix the misconception that the enemies are brothers.
I bang on the setup, bang on the setup, bang on the setup, upset the setup, bang on the setup, bang on the setup, bang on the setup, homie, we been set up.
I tell them, I went from a street gang thing, then I joined a military fleet marine force thing. From a little bitty gang in the south of Los Angeles to dragging bodies out of their house to help a government who hell bent on keeping money spent on the missile. The reality's the difference between them shits is little. We had the objective of arming up over money, and they had the objective of arming up over money. And we told kids join us, we the truth. Lies about protecting our flock to get recruits. Then we found out we getting killed for a hood. And we don't own a single speck of dirt on that hood. Whether in a zone down south in Decatur, or in a flatlands off of Lenox and La Brea, or in a low-rise project in Chicago, big money come in and buy up our body.
Throw your sets up, we about to upset the setup. We about to upset the setup. Up to upset the setup. Throw your sets up, we about to upset the setup. Upset the setup. Up to upset the setup.
I do it for the Crips and the Blooders, BGF brothers, the real Freeway Ricky Ross and Chris Dutters. I do my thing for Hoover, I represent for Ford. So my folk and my people, so they set to support. Support a mean to Matthew, she might say the shot. So maybe next summer, no mama gotta cry. Maybe next summer, nobody gotta die. Hell, even if we fail, somebody gotta try. The only way the system rule is somebody gotta lie. And the lie they told is old, they base it on your race. They separate you black, you brown, you yellow and white face. Then we further separate by joining gangs and legislate. That our neighborhoods are now at war like we are separate states. So the police occupy our hood to keep down all the drama. So the Starbucks they just built is comfortable for soccer mama. And American apparel comfortable for all the hipsters. And it's zero tolerance for all you spicks and you niggas and you chinks and you crackers. And it ain't about who's whiter and it ain't about who's blacker, but the money is a factor. And the factor is the factor we've got moved up out the hood. When starvation is present and absent is a job, a man with simple scars, or he will form a mob. If you should form a mafia, then you should think Sicilian. Buy the hood for real, every block, every building, every build, every build. Feed the chill, feed the chill. Gang bang, gang bang. Build, build. Feed the chill, feed the chill. Feed the chill, feed the chill. Gang bang, gang bang. On the system, on the system.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer, right?
Yes.
And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
You
be a peaceful revolution.
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over.
Mr. Jackson, sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it. I'll see you today. Get him where it hurts.
Starring Gary Dorden from TVCSI.
This is the military, David.
Free the Lab, Revolutionary Greetings. Welcome to another edition of Joy Emerson Radio. I'm your host, Bumon Shakir. I'm going to be joined with a special co-host, Bob Masai Hosey, that's on with me as well. I would like to go to our goals of Georgia University, which is fivefold. Our first goal, to eradicate foster literacy among new African prisoners. Our second goal, to eradicate culture ignorance among new African prisoners. Our third goal, to transform the criminal mentality to the new African mentality. Our fourth goal, to assist in the rebuilding and stabilization of new African communities. Our fifth goal is to prepare new African prisoners for release, reducing new African recidivism. And our overall goal is to transform the prison slave complex to the prison system, to the big interest of learning through educational means. Before I bring on a guest tonight, I'd like to go over a couple of events that happened in history during this week. On February 27, 1865, Senator Charles Sumner and his associates used dilatory tactics to block a vote on the admission of representatives from the Lily White Lincoln government in Louisiana. 1869, John W. Menard spoke in Congress in defense of his claim to a contested seat in Louisiana in the 2nd Congressional District. The Congress decided against both claimants. Congressman James A. Garfield of the Examining Committee said it was too early to admit a Negro to the U.S. Congress. Menard was the first black to make a speech in Congress. 1872, Charlotte E. Ray, the first black woman lawyer, graduated from Howard University and was admitted to practice on April 23rd. On February 28, 1871, the Second Enforcement Act of Congress gave federal officers and court control of registration and vote in congressional districts. 1942, a race riot occurred in the Sojourner Truth homes in Detroit. In 1964, Carl T. Rowan succeeded Edward Morrow as director of the U.S. Information Agency. In 1977, comedian Eddie Rochester Anderson died in Los Angeles at the age of 71. In 1998, Todd Duncan, the original Porgy and Bess, died in Washington at the age of 95. In 2004, U.S. troops removed democratically elected Haitian president Jean Bertrand Aristide. On March 1st, 1841, Blanche Keslow Bruce was the first black to serve a full-term United States Senate. He was born a slave in Prince Edward County, Virginia. 1871, J. Milton Turner, named Minister to Liberia, and became the first black diplomat accredited to an African country. James W. Mason was named minister in March 1870, but never traveled to his post. 1875, the Congress passed the Civil Rights Bill of 1875, required equal rights and equal treatment in inns, public conveyance, theaters, and other places of public amusement. In 1934, the great Bobby Wright was born. Bobby Wright was a scholar, a psychologist. He was an author. And he spoke very outright against the mental oppression and white supremacy in the social fields of psychology and psychiatrists. On March 2nd, 1807, the Congress banned the slave trade, prohibiting the importation of slaves into the United States or the territory thereof after January 1st, 1808. 1867, Howard University was founded in Washington, D.C. Also in 1867, blacks voted in municipal election in Alexandria, Virginia, perhaps the first time in the South. The election commission refused to count the 1,400 votes, and military officials suspended local election pending clarification of the status of the freedmen. 1867, black voted First of a secession of Reconstruction Act passed by Congress divided the former Confederate states into five military districts under the command of Army generals. Elections were ordered for constitutional conventions, and freedmen were enfranchised, commanding some states change the status of black by military orders. In March, Major General E.R.S. Canby opened the jury box to black in South and North Carolina. On April 30, blacks were named policemen in Mobile, Alabama. In 1885, George W. Williams, minister, lawyer, and historian, named Minister Haiti. The appointment was vacated by the new administration. In 1966, President Kwame Nkrumah arrived in Guinea. Okay. On March 3rd, 1820, the Missouri Compromise Act, the measure prohibited slavery to the north or southern boundary of Missouri. 1821, Thomas Jennings became the first black to be granted a patent for the dry cleaning process. 1865, the Congress established a Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands, known as the Freedmen's Bureau, to aid white refugees and former slaves. Also in 1865, the Freedmen's Saving and Trust Bank was headquartered in District Columbus, chartered by government with business confined to African Americans. On March 4, 1861, in his inaugural address, President Abraham Lincoln endorsed a proposed constitutional amendment that would have guaranteed slavery in America forever and said his administration posed no threat to the interests of Southern slave owners. Frederick Douglass and other abolitionists criticized the speech. He said slavery forever. 1865, Lincoln delivered his much praised second inaugural address, but did not discuss his Reconstruction plan and did not mention black suffrage or equal rights. Scripted its self-serving theology, it was a plea for leniency for Confederates and a continuation of white supremacy under another name. In 1908, Dr. T.R.M. Howe, outspoken black activist, self-defense advocate, surgeon, and businessman, mentor of future black politician, was born in America. Marion, Kentucky. On March the 5th, 1707, Christopher Attucks was the first of five persons killed in the conflict between English soldiers and Boston citizen called the Boston Massacre. Some historians are calling him the first martyr of the American Revolution. 1875, Blanche Keslow Bruce was sworn in as a U.S. senator. Mississippi politician was the first black to serve a full term in the Senate. His term ended on March 3, 1881. 1897, the American Negro Academy was founded in the Lincoln Memorial Church in Washington on the anniversary of Christopher Attucks' martyrdom in the Boston Massacre. Alexander Cromwell was elected president. In 1981, the U.S. government granted Atlanta some $1 million to finance mental health and social programs in the wake of a mysterious series of abductions and slaying involving at least 22 black youths. You know, those are a couple of events happening in history this week. You know, there are plenty more, but the show must go on. All I say, free land, those identify the land, revolutionary ingredients, long live the resistance. And I also want to acknowledge that this that we'll commemorate, acknowledge National Women's History Week from a new African perspective at that. You know, and I'd like to welcome to the show tonight, Mama and Fia and Wangazi. How you doing, Mama?
Hanging in there. How about you?
I'm doing strong. I'm doing strong. It's always a pleasure to hear your voice. Always a pleasure to connect, you know, and do this work. You know, but before we get into this meet, tell the people a little bit about yourself before we get into the meeting situation, man, you know.
Well, I was born into the movement to Pentecostal pastor and missionary under the influence and training of Marcus Garvey, and thought that and worked for the liberation of our people first through the church. And as I began to understand and mature at age 13, I decided that perhaps politics might be useful and became a member of the Virginia Youth and College Chapters of the NAACP, became the secretary for the state of Virginia team, and eventually left Virginia and went to live in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where I continue to at first work with the NAACP in support of then-President Cecil B. Moore, who committed to breaking the will of Stephen Girard having been a gun runner and turned financier, having stolen money from the Haitian Revolution, taking money to buy guns and not returning the guns, used the money to seed a bank, banking industry here in Philadelphia. And when he died, he left a will donating his money for the creation of a school for poor white male orphans. That school eventually established in North Philadelphia, which had become at my time in the mid-60s a black community. Well, we would see these young white boys running in and out, and none of the young people, none of the young men in the community were eligible to attend. So Cecil Moore, just an attorney, decided that he was going to break the will and desegregate the school. It had been attempted before by Sadie and Raymond Alexander, excuse me, black lawyers and president of the earlier president of the NAACP, but they were not successful. Cecil, however, put together a combination of a legal strategy and street heat and was able to break the will. So today, Girard College is desegregated, and both black and white male orphans are able to attend that school. But at the same time, as a high school student, I would have began working with brothers who had returned to Philadelphia from working in Mississippi during the summer of 64, and who had come under the influence of Malcolm X. So I began my training at that point with a flourishing and development of my understanding of the Garvey movement and the principles of the Garvey movement as was reflected in the church practices, do for self. John Churchville and Bill Strickland, Ahmed, Max Stanford, I'm trying to think of his African name, from RAM, all of them coming together. Ahmed Muhammad. All of these forces coming together, and in my own experience, and the times, we were at that time also as a part of the Girard College confrontation, fighting with local police while the cops were running hoses and horses over black people in the South. Leary, who was the police chief here in Philadelphia before Rizzo, was running jeeps and horses over black people. Our response to that as young people was to flatten the tires of the patrol cars and break off the antennas. We eventually created what came to be called Northern Student Movement Freedom Library Day School in the heart of North Philadelphia, where there was after-school program for tutoring, and eventually became a day school for people can see what the teaching was at the day school. On YouTube, there's a Lost, Stolen, or Strayed, was a series that Bill Cosby did that was sponsored by Xerox. And we learned and taught our children bringing the Freedom School concept and principle up north to Philadelphia, recognizing that the problems that we were dealing with in the South were present in the North. And as Malcolm said, anything below the Canadian border was South. So we began working there. And as a high school student, and then once I completed high school, went to Atlanta, began working with SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, working first in the national office and then moving on to Vine City and Atlanta Project, which at first was the special project for the re-election, or special election rather, of Julian Bond, because the Georgia Assembly had refused to seat him given SNCC's opposition to the United States war on Vietnam. Once that campaign was successfully won, both in the streets and in the courts, then we on the Atlanta Project began to look at where we were, where we are, and where we needed to go as a people. And we drafted what is commonly known as the Black Power Position Paper for the SNCC Atlanta Vine City Project. People can Google, and that paper will come up in various forms, including its original form. It was, while it eventually was popularized by Kwame Ture, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, and others in the leadership of SNCC, including Jim Foreman, it was not accepted or well received by any of them to begin with. In fact, Kwame, on his first reading of the paper, flipped it across the room and said, "You motherfuckers are crazy. You're trying to destroy SNCC," because he understood that the funding of SNCC came from white people. And one of the things that we were saying was that white people need to go and organize white people and let black people organize black people for various reasons, and most notably that we set our own agenda, that we create a space where we could establish self-determination, establish our own goals, our own priorities, our own strategies and tactics. And that white folks could be allies and be supporters, but they could not be leaders in our struggle for freedom, that we had to be our own leaders. And that has been my course of conduct ever since, whether it's being a co-founder of Malcolm X Grassroots Movement for Self-Determination, in COBRA, the African American Institute for Policy Studies and Planning in Greenville, South Carolina, and the Malcolm X Center for Human Rights and Self-Determination, WMXP 95.5 FM Community Radio. I have continued the process of working for the liberation of our people.
Okay. That's with some beautiful history, especially related to your involvement, you know what I'm saying, as a woman in these different struggles from the civil rights movement, from the pan-African national movement to the new African independent movement, right, you know, which is a very prominent movement in regard to our evolution, as well as a prominent movement in regard to our particular position right now in this time's age, right? My first question to you is, what actually does Women History Month mean to you as a new African woman? What does it mean to you?
Well, you know, one of the things about growing up, first of all, in the church and in the movement generally, because my parents really referred to their church work as the movement. Women have always held a strong and leadership position. In fact, in addition to being the Virginia State Secretary for the NAACP Youth and College Chapters at 15, At 13, I was the chair of the Junior Missionaries Society in my father's church. So the role of women has always in my life and experience been a strong and essential position in the advancement of African people. Now, there was, it's problematic in terms of the who did the work and who got the credit and the pat on the back was problematic. And for me, became a point of real contention and was contributed to my ultimate shift from viewing the church as a pathway to freedom and beginning to experiment with secular approaches, political approaches, as represented by participation in the NAACP. There's that continuing, even today, tension between our matriarchal, matrilineal heritage and the patriarchal imposition of European culture on us as a people, where our definition of freedom has been defined as black males being able to operate in ways that it was thought or is thought that white males operated, that the definition of manhood was to operate like a white male, not recognizing that the whole concept of manhood and even womanhood are political constructs as opposed to biological ones and have little or nothing to do with struggle for liberation, especially when we engage with Sister Dr. Frances Cress Wilson called the great equalizer, that is the gun and other forms of technology. So when I think about Women's History Month, I think about the sisters with whom I have been co-workers, comrades, and sisters in this struggle for freedom.
Okay, I like that answer because, you know, the reason I asked is because Black Women History Month started as a Women History Day in 1978. It was basically pushed by a European woman. Then it became Women History Week in 1980. Then it didn't become Women History Month in 1987, right? And doing some of the commemoration, it commemorated a lot of white women's suffrage movement, but it also included people like Harriet Tubman, you know, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, and other individuals like that, because during that particular time, during that, whereas from a New African perspective, it's not totally different. I was struggling not including into that situation because it wasn't what the acknowledgement was about, even though we don't turn it around to highlight, commemorate, and celebrate, you know, and also educate people in regard to our women and our history from our various movements, be it New African Independent Movement, Black Liberation Movement, Pan-African International Movement, even the Civil Rights Movement, right? So that's why I asked you that question, you know, which is a beautiful thing. I like the way you express it. You know, from a legal perspective, right, you know, I know it have been various people that had contributed to the particular struggle, right, in regard to certain things, like Ida B. Wells, Harriet Tubman, Maria Stewart, you know, and also like been certain like political cases, like the sisters from the RNLF, like Mama Tamu, Mama Aisha, Mama Injiri, you know, there's been certain cases like that. You know, but, what are some of the significance of some of these histories to you and what does it mean to other sisters as well in regard to knowing about these particular histories or knowing about these particular movements? And how do some of these historical events and movements relate to the current movement right now that we have on today, as well as some kind of historical movement as well? How do it relate to all that? How can it like ties and interwoven into some of those aspects?
Well, you know, you raised the question about the law and what I call Anglo-U.S. jurisprudence, because when you say the law, natural law is immutable. You know, the law of physics, need determines function and function determines structure, doesn't change. But Anglo-U.S. jurisprudence changes to meet the needs of the those in charge, recognizing that the United States is an ongoing criminal enterprise built with stolen labor on stolen land, codified by the commercial document called the U.S. Constitution, which is designed to protect and promote the commercial interests of white male property owners, can hardly be considered the law. So I refer to it as Anglo, meaning British, English, U.S. jurisprudence. And one of the people who comes to my mind immediately is a ancestor named Almanina Barber, who's the daughter of J. Pius Barber, who was one of the counselors and advisors of the young Martin Luther King Jr. We rarely, in fact, most people, unless they know the deep King history, don't even know the name of J. Pius Barber, who was one of the leading black ministers in this country, along with Reverend Thurman, who was a strategist, a movement strategist, organizing the National Black Baptist Convention participation, as limited as it was, in support of the movement. But Almanina was a lawyer in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She's one of the first, I think she was like the third black to graduate from the University of Pennsylvania, second woman, Sadie Alexander being the first, who brought a lawsuit against Frank Rizzo as police commissioner for his having led the assault on black students who demonstrated at the Philadelphia School District demanding black studies program 50 years ago. That lawsuit was one of the earliest lawsuits against law enforcement. She was one of my mentors and certainly one of the leading legal minds in this country. When I think about the Anglo-U.S. jurisprudence and the criminal punishment system, I, of course, think of the full range of political prisoners, prisoners of war and exile, from Sister Fani Shakur, who was a pro se litigant in the Panther 21 case, a successful, I would add, pro se litigant. Others who were involved in defending themselves and the community against the legal system. Fulani Suni Ali, Asada Shakur, Nahandi Abiodun, Safia Bukhari, Connie Tucker, Angela Davis, Jesse Woods, the range of from politically conscious and active to the politicized as a result of their experience with with the law enforcement and legal system. I would add the other side of that coin is with regard to voting rights and ethics, and even above all, as establishing and symbolizing an ethical standard, a revolutionary standard, is Sister Fannie Lou Hamer, who was a SNCC worker from Ruleville, Mississippi. She is becoming increasingly recognized. We hear the little snippet, being sick and tired of being sick and tired, and is this America, when she confronted the Democratic, she on behalf of and with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party confronted the Democratic Party and Lyndon Baines Johnson and Hubert Humphrey regarding the seating of the segregated racist white delegation from Mississippi over the integrated grassroots delegation of the MFDP, Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, where she testified with regard to the terror and violence under which people lived, and not only lived, but that died as a result of simply registering to vote. And that when others were prepared to compromise, she expressed the will of the group by saying, when they offered two seats in the general participation of the conference of the convention, the Democratic Party convention, they were going to give them two seats rather in the general body rather than to expel the segregated Mississippi delegation. And she said, we don't want any two seats. We didn't come all this way for two seats. All of us is tired. And holding up the standard that our individual and our personal interests, our personal goals, our personal aspirations are secondary to the best interests and the aspirations and the needs of the people, that she would not allow herself to be distracted and convinced to sell out the community, would not allow herself to be schmoozed and coddled into giving them cover, being a buffer for their misconduct and their lack of ethics and their failure to not seat the segregated Democrats, but to seat the people. Another political prisoner that whose name most of us don't know, and that is Callie House. Callie House, along with her partner, Isaiah, and I wrote it down because I was afraid I was going to forget it, but was the co-founder of the National Ex-Slaves Mutual Relief Bounty and Pension Association, demanding reparation. She was the two of them, Isaiah, it'll come to me hopefully before I finish, the two of them were like Marcus Garvey, prosecuted and jailed for mail fraud because they demanded reparations and had the audacity to actually organize and to raise funds from black people to support the campaign to recover and obtain reparations. She's one of our earliest political prisoners. Amelia Boynton, Woman, for those folk who've seen that movie, Ava DuVernay's lopsided movie called Selma, Oprah plays the part of a woman who was beat in the head and collapses. That woman, who was also beaten on the bridge with John Lewis, her name was Amelia Boynton. She and her husband, beginning in the 1940s, had began a voting education and registration campaign in Alabama, in Selma. And she was the one who first invited SNCC to come into Alabama to help to organize the campaign. Then we were doing it, moving fast enough, getting enough publicity. So she invited Martin Luther King and SCLC. SNCC, unlike SCLC, did organizing from the bottom up, while SCLC did mobilizing, because they didn't do any organizing. They did mobilizing from the top down. Organizing from the bottom up is not only harder, but it takes longer. The proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. Organizers go together. Mobilizers go alone. So when SCLC and King and company left Alabama, taking John Lewis with them, all the cameras left, all the money left, and all the work would have left except SNCC stayed behind. So not only in Alabama, but Mississippi, Georgia, and throughout the South. There's very little that happens in this country that doesn't involve the laws. They say it's a country of laws, but they don't say what laws and how those laws work, and especially when they're selectively applied. I think about Sister Juanita Young in New York, who on Tuesday, joined with city council women in New York to refile a bill that was initially filed by Inez Darren some years ago when she was a member of the New York City Council. And that bill called for an elected independent prosecutor and citizens review board with powers for hiring and firing and subpoena powers to deal with the epidemic of law enforcement violence and terror. Juanita Young is one of the authentic mothers of the movement, whose son was Malcolm Ferguson, was murdered more than 22 years ago, and on whose account she fought to ultimately force the New York City Police Department and the city itself to answer for his death. And Louis Rivera, who is the cop who murdered Malcolm, said on the witness stand, because she wouldn't settle for the blood money, she forced them to try him, to litigate the case. He still hasn't been tried, and she hasn't given up. But he had to acknowledge on the witness stand in the civil case that he had no reason for having murdered Malcolm, that, in fact, that he did not know why he had shot and killed him. And as a result of that, she was able to recover what at the time was the largest damages for wrongful death by law enforcement of a black person up until that time. So she lent her name and her money and her compassion. She has spent the past more than 25 years working to support other families, to educate them, to share with them her experience. We've educated lawyers. You know, Klump didn't just pop out of nowhere. Black Lives Matter didn't just come out of nowhere. Those groups, Trayvon Martin and Sabrina Fulton, and all of that is the result of the seeding and nurturing of a movement that was initiated by the Revolutionary Communist Party, forming October 22nd Coalition and establishing the first database documenting police terror in this country. That database, the Stolen Lives Project, folks can go online to the StolenLivesProject.org, October 22nd, Coalition.org, to see the women who built that movement over the past 25 years, traveling across this country when it wasn't popular, it certainly was not profitable. In fact, we did it at our own expense, sweeping on gym floors and church basements, meeting with families wherever we could, and helping them to overcome the stigma and the presumption that if the cops killed your loved one, they may not have done what the cops said, but they must have done something, and therefore you had to keep your head low and say nothing. We broke that stigma, and Juanita Young was one of the mothers who did that. Another was Arnetta Grable out of Detroit, who was the co-founder of the Coalition Against Police Brutality in Detroit as a result of her son, Lamar Grable, being murdered by the Detroit police. She, too, refused to take a settlement and demanded that they have to take at least the civil side of it to court and force the cops involved to take the stand and to testify under oath as to what their rationalization was for murdering her son. Not only was she successful in exposing them, but she was also successful in obtaining one of the highest, in fact, the highest at the time, damages award for wrongful death by cops in the state of Michigan. So when I think about women, black women and the law, I think about a strong tradition of ethics and commitment and a recognition of the importance of resolving those matters in the interest of the masses of the people and not their personal careers, goals, or egos.
Okay, I appreciate that. You know, one of the elders said Callahan's husband's name was Isaiah Dickerson, right?
Thank you.
Isaiah Dickerson. No doubt. You know, in regard to what you were saying earlier about you saying that sister had been, like, some sisters had been political, some sisters had been politicized, and some people had been captured, incarcerated, exiled, and so forth and so on, right? You know, They kind of bring out the story of Joanne Little, right? You know,
right.
She was incarcerated. Mm-hmm. You know, she got incarcerated at a young age, and at that time in the place in North Carolina, they were taking advantage of the young women, abusing them, and molesting them, things of that nature, right? You know, in regards to that nature, so. What from a legal perspective and from your historical perspective, what actually is the significance of Joanne Little And where can women learn from her story that can be very influential to them today?
The story of Joanne Little is where she was incarcerated in a North Carolina jail, Buford, North Carolina, I believe it was. I believe it was Buford, North. I know it was North Carolina. I believe it was Buford, North Carolina. I think I'm correct in that. And she was a young woman who had been arrested for shoplifting. And here the jailer was going to take sexual liberties, was going to rape her. And she defended herself against it and killed him. And they wanted to, and they did, in fact, charge her with murder. However, it wound up being a rallying cry for the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, the international human rights movement, and they were forced ultimately to let her go. She, along with Desi Woods, it's another case in which these young women were apolitical, but were politicized as a result of the assault on their dignity as a human being. And that is the lesson that we, not only women, but we all have to learn and to observe and to practice. And that is that there must be no compromise and no retreat from the dignity and upholding the dignity of us as human beings and of Black women especially, which has been going through the Holocaust of enslavement, disregarded, disrespected, discounted for centuries. And so we have these moments where young women take the position that we are not going to tolerate that disrespect. Of course, there are still jailers and cases and situations today where sexual abuse runs rampant. There was recently, I believe it was Alabama, where a prison, the U.S. Injustice Department finally got itself together and brought an action against the state of Alabama and forced them to close down a prison because of their inability to provide the necessary security for the women in that prison. We find that in case of juvenile prisons and detention centers where our children, and that's who's in there, our children are being sexually and physically and mentally and chemically abused. So the lesson has to be that the necessity, the essence of our movement has to be the protection and promotion and advancement of human dignity, of our dignity as individuals and as a people.
Okay, true indeed. I like that. Well, you know, right now, and we're going to go to modern history. Right now we have a female president of the Visiting Republic of Africa, right, who, what actually does that signify to you as a woman in the struggle, that they've been in the struggle since the 60s? What does it signify to you to have as well as being a type of citizen? What does that signify to you?
It is historic. It's about time. Not only are women doing the work, but they are the face and the voice of the people, which brings us full circle to our matrilineal and matrifocal and matriarchal heritage. The struggle, of course, becomes to garner for them and with them the support that is necessary to advance the movement, to advance the mission of the Republic of New Africa under their leadership. You know, we work ourselves to the bone when we've got a brother in charge or appearing to be in charge, but when it's sisters, we have a tendency to be overly critical. We have a tendency to not be willing to give them the kind of support that not only do they need and are entitled to, but that we as a people need and are entitled to. It also says to me that we have come to the point that we understand that this point in time is a nurturing point in time, and I don't want us to suggest that only women can nurture. However, it is that at this point in time that we have been socialized such that it is more likely that a woman is going to be a nurturer and than it is for brothers. All brothers are encouraged to be protectors and providers in an environment where protection and provisions are asexual, agender. And not only that, where that as a standard of value of humanity, especially for males, has been put out of the reach of the masses of the males in our community, that we, when we hang on to that patriarchal notion, Eurocentric patriarchal notion of what it means to be a valuable male human being, then we defeat ourselves and our purpose. We are engaged in sabotage, self-sabotage. So it is a challenge, a historic challenge, an opportunity for growth to celebrate the Samayat, President Samayat, and the vice president, and you're going to have to give me her name, for us to rise to the occasion.
Her name, Mama Ayo Dele. Mama Ayo Dele, Kofi. Mama Ayo Dele. Mama Ayo.
Thank you. Mama Ayo, right. Thank you. To rise to the occasion and become real revolutionaries and step forward and help to make the work lighter. So when I you know, I apologize. In fact, I talked to them a few days ago, and I apologize that I myself have not been more available and more supportive. But that is that not only is it our duty, but it is our challenge. If we're going to become a mature people and overcome the impact of the assault of the past 400 years, then we will have to recognize the authority and to put forth the resources, material, emotional, spiritual, military resources that are necessary in order to make their administration successful. It's in their success that we are successful and prepared to move to the next level.
True indeed. When I look at their history, like you said, it's a beautiful history. You look at the origin of things. Queen Mother Moore was the first one to sign the Declaration of Independence. And even at the original founding, it was a lot of sisters present. Queen Mother Moore, Joanne Franklin, Mommy Aida Ferguson, you know, and so other individuals, a lot of people present, but Dr. Betty Shabazz, you know, the list goes on and on. If you look at that particular aspect of things, you know, it's always been like more of a balanced situation, but historically, the first president was Mama Dog Abercrombie, you know, and that was in 78. It hasn't been no female president since Samat became the president, which would make the second president, female president in the history of freedom for Bobby Africa, where there also had been other women that held position, such as Minister of Information, Minister of Defense, Minister of Education, so forth and so on, right? It's always a beautiful thing, man. And, you know what I'm saying? And it also plays a
Mama Yael Ferguson, who was the president of the ICC at one point, was she not? The International House of Justice?
I'm not sure about that. You know, not sure.
I believe that she was, and she has certainly been a stalwart throughout the history of the provisional government, along with ancestor Herman Ferguson, former political prisoner himself and leader, educator and leader of the Ocean Hill, one of the leaders of the Ocean Hill Brownsville School. I want to check myself on the use of the term leader. We get that notion of leader, whether we like it or not, leadership is a collective process. It's not even a set, fixed formation. It's who's got the information of the question of the day, and that varies depending on the quantum and quality of information that anyone in the group has. So I was thinking about the Montgomery bus boycott. The women who actually founded and organized the Montgomery Improvement Association, of which the Montgomery bus boycott was a project. We hear the name, we all know the story, we know the myth, the lie of Rosa Parks, that she didn't get up because her feet were tired, which of course is not true. But that it was a planned and organized event that catapulted Martin Luther King to international fame and a Nobel Prize. And the myth of his leadership continues to this day. But the truth of the matter is that it was black women, and one of whom most of us never heard of, and that's Joanne Robinson, who was an English teacher at Alabama State College, now Alabama State University. The three women who actually started the movement, Joanne Robinson, Lottie Green Varner, and Rosa Parks, Lava Thomas. And, of course, even before them, there was a young black woman, Corbett, I believe is her last name. You'll check me on that, who actually took the seat and refused to get up. But because she wasn't a part of the civil rights clique and wasn't from the acceptable class, did not get the recognition or support. In fact, it's only been in recent weeks that the governor of Alabama pardoned her, 70 years after the fact, pardoned her and expunged her record. So the role of women, black women, in the liberation of African people, as well as in our survival and thriving, because despite the oppression, we have thrived. We've created the only music that this country has ever produced. We have impacted everything from the food to clothes to lifestyle. And even though there is a pushback against us, we've impacted the law. So the impact of the African woman in this country and continues to be present while it's not recognized. Ida B. Wells. When we talk about voting rights for women, not only did she initiate and lead the anti-lynching campaign, was a co-founder of the NAACP, but she also campaigned and forced white women to include black women in the struggle for women's suffrage. There's nowhere and nothing in this country that the black woman hasn't touched, and that her fingerprints are on, known or unknown.
True indeed. True indeed.
You mentioned Maria W. Stewart. I wanted to point out that Maria W. Stewart was the first woman, black or white, in this country to write and publish political tracts. You know, we hear about Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, but Maria W. Stewart, born a free black, wrote, published, and was the first woman to speak to so-called mixed audiences. Mixed meaning it was both male and female, as well as racially mixed audiences. She traveled up and down the East Coast lecturing and calling especially black women to leadership and to struggle. One of her common sayings was, "O ye daughters of Africa, hide ye not your pot, your will and under your pots any longer." Maria W. Stewart is important that we read her tracks. She was a contemporary and comrade of David Walker in Boston. She was based in Boston.
Beautiful history. I want to ask you, what does it mean for us to support Mama Asad Secure, and what does she mean to the particular movement? What does she mean to the new African independent movement, and what is the Black Liberation? What does she mean to the movement in general? What are her significance? Right? What are her significance to you? What are her significance to the movements?
Well, you know, I've had the good fortune of going to Cuba and of meeting Mama Asada Shakur. And I think that, that she is in the line of the Cali houses of our struggle, of those who have dared, Connie Tucker, those who have dared to stand up, Amelia Boynton, with or without the use or the recommendation of the use of arms. Sometimes, you know, a word was mightier than a sword is the pen. So continuing that line of resistance, and her sacrifice, or more accurately, her investment in our freedom, as represented by being in exile, along with now ancestor Mahanda Abiodun, again holds up that standard of commitment and integrity that was reflected in Fannie Lou Hamer's statement, "We didn't come all this way for no two seats, all of us is tired." And what I see Asada saying in her exile, people think because you're not behind bars is not as bad. No, it is in some ways it's worse. Because not only are you apparently at liberty, but the bind, the limitations are less visible in exile than in prison. When you're in prison, you know you're in prison. You know there's certain things that you cannot do, and if the guard doesn't come and unlock the door, you know you're not leaving that cell. When you're in exile, it's all in your head and in your being in an entirely different kind of way. And we really do have to begin to think about the impact of being in exile as opposed to or along with the physical limitations of the physical cell. I was going to make another point about her being in exile, and not only being in exile, but being in exile in a situation where she is also limited in terms of her being able to do her work in the way that she had been able to do it before going into exile, and that is to lecture and to speak and to train and to be in fellowship with other comrades, that the films that she has done, her book, are all available and useful and speak to another generation at the same time. What kind of growth and development would she and we enjoy should she be able to freely work from Cuba, or even better still, to be here in community with us, helping us to find our way to the next level?
I have one more question and open the line for callers. I seen a picture online. It was a picture of you and Wanda Cooper Jones, right? Can you tell a little bit about that meeting and what type of person is she, and what kind of vibe did she give out to you when you met her? You know, Wanda Cooper Jones, the mother of Ahmaud Arbery.
Now, that sister is a mother of the movement. She's not one of these folks that the Democrat Party has trotted out to give them cover and color. Wanda Cooper Jones is a sister, a genuine, what you see is what you get. While she is no nonsense, she is also warm, compassionate, approachable, frank. It was an honor to meet and to work with her and be with her at a conference, a national conference in Minnesota during the George Floyd upsurge, and that's all it was an upsurge of a movement that had been started many years ago. even sooner than the 25 years of the October 22nd Coalition Stolen Lives Project. She along with mothers from across the country, met in Minneapolis, Minnesota, to talk about their next steps and their vision for what they believed we ought to be doing in order to begin to shape justice and to bring an end to police terror and violence. She counseled with other sisters who were there, other mothers who were there. She talked about, and there were Clarence, I believe his first name was Clarence Kutcher, who had been shot down in his as he walked away from this white woman cop, shot him down. The sisters of Boston John, who was shot by a cop while he's sitting in his living room eating ice cream. They all embraced one another, and she was in the center of it. And even though she was one of the more recent survivors, she, on the other hand, was so wise and so warm that people just gravitated to her. And she talked about the struggles that she had had to demand answers. She reminded me very much of Arnetta Grable, who, when her son Lamar Grable was murdered by the Detroit policeman, and his name escapes me. Usually I can say what his name is. But wherein Arnetta, when they took his body to the morgue, Arnetta got in her car and drove over to the morgue and sat outside the office of the room where the autopsy was being conducted. Wanda Cooper Jones essentially did the same thing when she said to the local police department, "I want to know what happened to my son," to the Brunswick police department. And she stayed on the phone, on the computer, in person. She would not allow them to rest. And when they gave her some bogus answer, she came back. She went to the next level, and she kept moving until she got what she knew was in the interest not only of her, of Ahmaud Arbery's case and steps towards justice or accountability, more accurately, and we must never, never settle for so-called accountability, because the truth of the matter is they're not accountable, especially when they can retire from the police department or the sheriff's office and collect their pension for the rest of their life. That's not any kind of accountability. But that she was able to share that with the mothers who were there, the daughters and sisters, and who has set a new standard for what is to be expected of family members in their pursuit of justice for their loved ones. And the fact that she forced the resignation of the prosecutor is historic. That is historic. That is a whole nother level of dismantling the apparatus of criminal punishment in this country, notwithstanding the fact that it's only one case, but it's never happened before. And I'm not one, I often say never, but that has not happened before. And what is even more historic is that she has pressed, and that woman, prosecutor, is going to be prosecuted. Now, she may not be convicted, and if she's convicted, she may not go to jail like Miss Kim Potter in Minnesota, where the judge is weeping that she has to sentence her to 2 years for killing somebody. But the fact of the matter is that Wanda Cooper Jones has taken the process to a whole nother level of accountability and demand for accountability of all the way up the chain of command, up to the prosecutor. We, on one hand, take delight in the so-called progressive prosecutors who across the country who are emerging, but we also have to get rid of the ones that are the gatekeepers and who prevent cops from being prosecuted for murdering members of our community. She is an exceptional, truly exceptional black woman. She is. It was an honor to meet and to be in her presence.
Okay, I appreciate that. At this time, I'm opening line for a few callers. I got a caller from 314-381. Your line is open. You have a question, comment, statement, please do so at your time. 314-381, your line is open.
You know, in St. Louis, they got an advocacy group, or the organization that have groups that work with victims of crime, instructing them how to file civil lawsuits against those who violate and cause them damage. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you one instance like this first step,
mm-hmm.
that mm-hmm. those that are allowed to participate in that, they must be willing to stand trial in a civil suit. Because mm-hmm. they caused a lot of damage. You made mention of Potter. Deontay Wright had shot an 18-year-old in the head who's now a vegetable in a wheelchair. And his mother, matter of fact, he's a mixed kid. His mother's white. She's got to take care of him the rest of her life.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, they kept that out of the media until the very end.
You know, another thing, too, ma'am, that really gets to me. You got some black young women getting out of school, get their first job, get a car so they can have transportation back and forth to work. Leave the car parked out on the curb, come out the next morning, it's knocked all up on the sidewalk, tore up, nobody to be seen. Now, that young lady just not getting the job and is still faced with paying for that vehicle, and she has no way to get to work. And these mm-hmm. idiots have ran. That's the praying that goes on in black society. And that's the setback.
I agree with you that's a problem that we have to deal with. You know, one of the And that's something that we all have to deal with. We remember that we keep us safe. The police don't keep us safe. We keep each other safe. You know, in some cultures, it is where people do engage in self and other destructive behavior that the community. Brings them before the community and engages in transformative and restorative justice. That's because we're looking out for each other. Now, when that, whoever that was that wrecked that car, somebody in the community knows who that person is. And it becomes the responsibility of that person who knows to not tell the police, but to bring it to the elders in the community to address that so that that person has to redress his or her misconduct and at the same time make the community whole. What you're describing is the situation of a sick village, and that's one of the issues that we have to deal with. We are the only ones who can deal with that, who are going to make us whole.
You know, Wright, when he drove away after being shot, he had an accident with a car where the driver was suffering from cancer. And the injuries and that, and the stress put him into hospice. But, you know, you talk about a sick village. When they draw red lines around those sick villages telling people to beware, then everybody gets mad. I think it goes deeper than that. You talk about prosecutors. Kim Fox in Chicago let out, or should I say, done away with 29,000 felony charges. 29,000 felony charges. These people are right back out on the street. I don't know. I think the system is trying to put that type of fifth column out in the public, whereas it can prey off of those who's trying to do the right thing. You know, children having to run down the street zigzag with bulletproof backpacks. That's totally ridiculous. Yeah, I mean, it's just shameful.
Yeah. I agree with you. And Kim Fox, that situation existed before Kim Fox became the prosecutor, and it'll exist after Kim Fox. The question is, and I don't want to skip off the redlining, because that's a form of violence against the black community that causes a sick village. The 29,000 felonies, that I don't know what the mix of the felonies were. We know that our communities are over-policed. We know that the folks that are harassed and persecuted and prosecuted by the cops are overcharged. So I trust Kim Fox before I would trust anybody else to make that decision, because, see, she lives in the black community in Chicago. So she is not going to do a whole bunch of stuff that's going to result in putting her and her family at risk.
Well, I'm going to let you guys get back to you. I'm going to say this and let you get back to your show. As of 273 days, as of February the 28th, last Monday, you know, had 3,742 blacks shot by other blacks. No white police shot, nobody. Mm-hmm. I think it may have been Warner, too. With 516 murders, 273 days. That there is just, and nobody seems to be talking about that, ma'am.
No, I guess
nobody's talking
about
that.
No,
I'm talking about news.
Who? When you say nobody, what do you mean?
Other
who
than
you
well,
to?
You get the, other than the sources, which is the Chicago Tribune. The Chicago Sun-Times and ABC7 Chicago, this is where these shootings are reported. You don't hear them on CNN. You don't hear them on Fox and none of the other mainstream. Then when you talk to people like Danny Davis, they don't have no concern. He's a congressperson, long-term congressperson in the area.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't take up for these fools. Thank you very much, ma'am.
Neither do I. And Danny Davis, I think that there is very clearly a problem in that regard. And for us to expect the white corporate media to chronicle issues of concern to us, especially in a way that serves us, is unrealistic. So let's just put that out there to begin with. And we have the black media is, I'm not sure where that is anymore. In fact, in Greenville, South Carolina, where I live, I call it the don't worry, be happy sheet, because it doesn't have an ounce of relevant news in it. I'm in the process of putting together a think tank to begin to challenge and support a position that a brother who is a doctor in Chicago raised many years ago, and unfortunately I don't remember his last name, but his first name was Carl. And anybody who can help us with that, I would appreciate it, because I would like to be able to give him credit for calling upon us to deal with the question of self and other destructive violent behavior towards one another as a health problem as opposed to a legal problem. In addition to that, and along that line, I've begun organizing a think tank on looking at the use of psychotropic drugs on our children
say your name, Dr. Carl Bell.
Yes, thank you, Carl Bell. I'm gonna write that down because I don't want to forget that. Yes, Carl Bell. He campaigned to try and get us to deal with the question of interpersonal violence as a health problem, which it is, as opposed to a legal problem. And contributing to the redlining, which means that we are excluded from economic development, even with our own resources, being able to leverage them, those resources in a way that serves the full community, is the prescribing of drugs to our children at early ages for extended periods of time. In fact, in some instances, for a lifetime. And right on the label, where you look at the effects, and then they may have a little warning where they say that it suppresses physical growth. Now, if it suppresses your physical growth, you know it suppresses your brain growth, right? So that means that when you give a child speed, which is what Ritalin and all these other drugs are, when you give them these drugs at 4 and 5 years old, and it's suppressing their growth, they're suppressing the development of their brain, and they get that for free until they are maxed out of school at 16, or they're aged out of the foster care program, so-called foster care program, at 18, and they can no longer get free drugs, then they go through withdrawal. They go through competition with one another as to how they're going to get these drugs. So, and I'm not the only one who is thinking along these lines. There are doctors who have in addition to Carl Bell, white doctors who have been calling for the stopping giving children adult drugs. And in fact, they recommend that adults don't even get these drugs, that they're nothing but poison that impact the physical makeup of the brain of the person taking them, as well as having negative effects on other parts of their body. So it's a lot more complicated rather than just ain't nobody talking, because see, CNN ain't us anyway. In our community, we are talking. Now, we look at Clyburn, James Clyburn from South Carolina. We know he's not going to talk about poisoning our kids with psychotropic drugs, because he is one of the biggest recipients of money from the pharmaceutical industry. So we know he's not going to be saying anything about it. But that's not an excuse for us not to be saying anything about it. The manipulation of poverty that results in mothers allowing the school district to prescribe drugs for elementary school kids, middle school kids, heavy drugs, speed, that is cooking their brains to in order to get an SSI check, because it pays more than a state welfare check. The economics of this whole business, we can look at the opioid epidemic and not just how it's being handled, but how it came about, and compare the parallels with the opioid epidemic and the psychotropic drug use on our children, and the impact that the opioids have had and the psychotropic drugs have had on the two communities and the response. Opioid is treated as a health problem. Psychotropic drugs are treated as a crime. We as a people have a duty to step up and protect our children. We in following the 54 school desegregation decision, we took our children by the hand and led them to the door of the white schools and walked away and left them. Generation after generation has been subject to all kinds of abuses, psychological, emotional, intellectual, physical, and chemical. It's time that we got back on the case. And I tell you, that's one of the things that women do that and see, because they are closest to the children, that brothers do not.
True indeed, true indeed. I'm about to open our line to right quick, the bottom of my side. I know he wanted his face on right quick before we ran out of time.
Okay, assalamu alaikum, free to land. It is always a pleasure to hear you, my sister, and I actually enjoyed listening to you tonight. I thought the information was real good. I know it could be useful to a lot of people. I did one of my notes, though. I mean, I had several, but one of them I wanted to mention to folks. When you mentioned the Black Power papers that was done by SNCC, I really think that people need to check it out, people really need to look at SNCC, what SNCC was and what it became, because they were actually organizers working among the people. But when they put that paper out, it was like one of the things, and they said it then, and I believe you said that Kwame Ture, somebody mentioned it, what was going to happen about the funding. And SNCC, do know that hit hard when they made that decision to where they wanted to concentrate their work. So I think it's a lot of lessons in there for people to look at that time, and actually the courage and commitment it took for folks to even put that paper out. Mm-hmm. And I was going to say, another thing related to that, I believe, though, like right after that, during the march, it was actually, I believe it was Mukasa that actually raised a call about Black Power. Willie Mukasa Ricks. After the paper. But I'm saying a lot of times folks associate the actual call to somebody else you mentioned, but Mukasa actually was one of the ones that raised it after the call. And I said I wasn't as much. I thought you answered last call well. I actually thought that was kind of like one of them set-up calls, because the person actually started off not with a solution, but a continuation of the problem. And as you know, I'm also one of them folks to relate to PIC abolition, prison industrial complex abolition. So we know it's not simple answers, but more imprisonment, redlining, locking up our youth. That contribute all the things you said. Those are part of the problems for us as a people, not a solution. And the way that person came off, like I said, I thought you handled it well, because I think some people would have lost their temper after the first two times, because the way they were coming at it, I might be wrong, but it definitely sounded like was more like a setup call, waiting to get that thing in about how we really need somebody else to police us.
Yeah,
I wanted to say that, and again, thank you for coming on, and thank you for that information, all of it.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. Always a pleasure to hear from you too, brother.
All right.
Yes. Thank
you. Hey, just one quick thing. Just for folks, if y'all didn't mention it, and I'm not sure how far it's out there, but you know there will be the memorial or something for Brother Ahmed. Okay.
I think a date has been set. I would encourage people to go on the Facebook page for the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement for Self-Determination, and I'm sure that whatever information.
Date is the 20th.
Okay. Okay.
Right, I would suggest going on there, too, because I'm not sure about how open it is to people and stuff like that. But, I just wanted to say that again.
The process here, people got to contact and reserve a particular email. But I'm opening up for another caller. 678-368, your line is open. Yeah, any questions, comments, statements? 678-368, your line's open.
Yes. I want to say Black Power, and, you know, I'm late. This is Mama Pearl. I was trying to make sure that I was there to greet the Queen. I'm so sorry I missed the whole thing, but I heard your tone and I felt your spirit. And I just heard something about an Ahmad pass. I'm hoping that's not the brother that I know. I just wanted to share my love with you all. This is, you know, National Women's Month, you know, quote, unquote, which they tried to hide with the National White Supremacist Women's Month, you know, but like you and I, we're aware of this, you know. Yeah, so, and I appreciate you so much. That's all I wanted to say. Love you, my brothers. Peace.
Thank you, sister. Thank you.
Thank you, Queen.
So well, you know, we must celebrate women every day. We celebrate the mother of humanity. We must celebrate Black women every day. That that's kind of like Black History Month. Now we have to teach and practice and celebrate and make Black history 365 days a year,
24/7. True indeed. Hold on, I want one more caller, then. Let me see if they have some. 614-285. You got any question, comment, state, please do us turn your lines open. 614-285, your line's open.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you.
Yes, it's
go ahead. Free line.
Can you hear me?
Yeah,
yes, ma'am. Oh, okay. There you are. Mama, I see you. This is your sister, Mama Condi. I miss you.
Oh, girl. It's so good to hear from you.
I miss you so much. I just sat here and I listened, and it just brought tears to my eyes. And I've really been going through it, and I'm in recovery now, and I'm going to try to do better with keeping in touch with you like I know I should, but I really do have an excellent excuse.
It's been really, really rough. And I just wanted you to know that I love you, and I thank you for being a trigger for my memory. You know, being from Norfolk.
Right.
It's just, it's like, you know, those things, those round things they put on your body to shock your body back in. It shocks you back into breathing. It's like that. That's what listening to you and other folks who came up with us, that's what that's like. And I thank you for that. I love you for that.
Thank you. Love you. And you,
love
you,
you, right back.
You know, no apologies are necessary because we know you doing the best that you could, and that's all that's required when we do the best that we can.
Thank you, sweetie pie.
Yeah, we know. Yeah, you ain't no new jack on the block. So it's great to hear from you. I really appreciate you calling in.
Thank you for allowing us to hear your voice, your thoughts, your memories, your work, your frequency, your vibration, your harmonics, and your syncopation.
All right. Okay, she done started writing poetry here and there. Thank you.
Bomani.
You work at your mom, Ken? Okay.
Yeah, that was a nice one.
Yes, ma'am.
I wanna make it clear that the Black Power position paper was written by the Atlanta Project of SNCC. We worked in Vine City, which was the poorest section of Atlanta, downtown Atlanta. And it was a group effort of the members of the project where we had study groups that we worked together to write it. The final paper itself was written by, even done as a collective with Donald Stone, Askia Teray, is another brother, Alton Patella, Zahara Simmons, Michael Simmons, but the lead writers were Stone, Patella, and Askia, who is a poet living in Boston now. And it was not accepted by the leadership of SNCC, including Kwame and even Mukasa. It wasn't until later on the March Against Fear when, in my opinion, Kwame was looking for a way to distinguish himself from Martin Luther King and to get the press's attention that he, along with Cleve Sellers and Courtland Cox, decided that they were going to advance Black Power. Embraced the position paper and the position that we had articulated in the paper. So I don't want that confused. I want people to be real clear that it took some doing. In fact, by the time that the organization adopted Black Power, the Atlanta Project had been dismantled and we had been driven out of the organization. So that was a struggle to force SNCC to embrace Black Power or Black self-determination, including Mukasa.
Okay, we appreciate the information. First of all, again, thank you for coming to our broadcast to share your knowledge, wisdom, understanding, your experiences. And I would like you to leave it with your final thoughts.
I would say that it's important that we, the way that we study during Black August, that this is a good time to study Black women's history. And I don't mean just the modern history. We, you know, it was this, as Fannie Lou Hamer used to say to us, to not forget the bridges that brought us across. We need to go back. If you're fortunate enough to have some women elders around, you need to take that smartphone and interview them and start preserving it. What is the music? What are the lessons in the music that that we have swept aside? That now is the time to understand that feminine side of our history and dig up the contributions of the women. And this month, there is a meeting of the Republic of New Africa. Find a way to be engaged, to find a way to support President Samayat and Vice President Ayo. Find a way to support a sister in your own neighborhood. Find a way to rebuild the sisterhood of the village so that we can heal this village. This recently I heard an African parable, or proverb rather, it said, if the village does not embrace the children will burn the village down. We have to find a way to embrace our children, and the only way we can do that is by rebuilding the village and thus rebuilding the nation. So find a way to support and to work with President Samayat and Vice President Ayo. That we can do, even if it's only for a month.
Okay. I appreciate that. In regards to that, New Afro Nation Day taking place March 25th to the 27th. It's an Eventbrite to talk about the 2022 New Afro Nation Day in Birmingham, Alabama. It's also, you also can find on the Instagram page, the Twitter page, the Facebook page. Africa. Instagram page is PG Republic of Africa. The Twitter page is Preventing the Republic of Africa. And the Facebook page, Republic of Africa. And y'all can find the other sites on social media, such as Georgia University, New African Independent Movement, New African Information Movement, and so forth and so on. And there's also, once you go to the event, you find out how you can purchase your ticket for the engagement, whether it be application day and the physical aspect, as well as how you can join it on Zoom. And I would say long live this long independent movement. If you got any loved one, comrade, associate, friends that are behind enemy lines, look at Georgia University and our website, www.georgiauniversity.com. Again, it's www.georgiauniversity.com. Law of the New African Independent Movement. Peace.